So, good morning everybody. Welcome back to another lecture on gravitational waves. So we just had the evaluation, so we start a little bit later. And as this is not a live stream, unfortunately, so I cannot tell you, please do the evaluation now, for those of you who are watching this video. Let's go on with the lecture. So we started with applications. So we started using the formula we derived in the last section and applied for the in-spiral of compact binaries. We were looking at a chirp mass, and we have seen that the gravitational wave amplitude is proportional to the chirp mass, that it draws energy from the orbital energy, and that the two neutron stars are orbiting each other closer and closer and closer, and thereby the frequency of the gravitational waves emitted will increase with time, and also the amplitude therefore will increase with time as they come closer and closer. And so the whole sequence sounds like a chirping bird, and therefore the name chirp mass. So far we studied everything for circular orbits. Now we want to do the same for elliptic Keplerian orbits, because one has seen high eccentricities also for binary neutron stars. So we need to talk about ellipticity. Before I start this, any questions about last lecture? Or no? Okay. So we're looking now at elliptic orbits. So let's draw a diagram about our variables. So here is x, this is y. This is one focal point of the ellipsis. And then let's try and draw a nice ellipse. And then we have A and B as the two parameters of the standard ellipse. Then we have a vector r pointing to the particle orbiting the other particle, and we have an angle psi. And the total length here, I wrote this one also down, is A1 plus epsilon. So there's a shift from the center of the ellipsis and the focal points, which is just given by the ellipticity E. So we in polar coordinates, we can rewrite a total energy by using that, let's write down the total energy. E is 1/2 reduced mass r dot squared plus L squared over 2 mu r squared. So this comes from the angular momentum, g mu m over r, the gravitational potential. And L is just defined as mu r squared phi dot, the angular momentum. Okay, so this is standard things you know from mechanics. So we can introduce now the angle phi by combining everything and just repeating everything. We can combine the equations and then get that 1 over r is 1 over capital R, while capital R is something I have to define. R is not, is defined as L squared over g m mu squared. And the ellipticity E squared can be recast in the form 1 plus 2 E times angular momentum L g squared m squared mu cubed. And this one I need later. Okay. Good. The ellipticity E, of course, varies between 0 and 1. Let's write this one here. And 1. 1 is not possible. If epsilon is 0, we have a circular orbit. Otherwise, we have elliptic orbits. We can write down now the solution in parametric form. So R is A times 1 minus E, and we introduce another variable U. And cosine phi, we can recast in cosine u minus the ellipticity over 1 minus e cosine u. Where u is the eccentric anomaly, so this is just standard Keplerian geometry. So U is called the eccentric anomaly. And it's implicitly defined by Kepler's equation that omega 0 times t is U minus the ellipticity, the sine of U, where omega 0 squared is defined as from Kepler's law for, and it looks like the one for circular orbits, but now we have, instead of r, the total radius, it's just the length of the ellipsis A, gm over A cubed. Okay? So, in this form, basically, the path of the two masses are basically is well defined, so everything can be solved more or less analytically, and with that one can now calculate the radiated power with the methods and we have derived in the last section, and this is a lengthy calculation. Radiated power then is given by P is 32 g to the fourth power reduced mass squared m cubed over 5 c to the fifth power a to the fifth power times a function which depends on the ellipticity e, and this function which depends on ellipticity is 1 minus e squared minus 7 half 1 plus, and there are two other correction factors, 73 over 24 e squared plus 37 over 96 e to the fourth power. Okay. And that calculation was done by Peters and Matthews in 1963. Okay. That is the easy part, but this is the hard part to get this one right. In any case, if we have no ellipticity of so circular orbits, means E is equal to 0, and then we see that when E is equal to 0, that F of 0 actually is just 1. Yeah, so we recover actually that this part here is just the solution we would have for circular orbits, and then there's a correction term which depends on ellipticity alone, which has this complicated dependencies on the ellipticity. Yeah? But this is basically the formula we have to use for the gravitation wave emission for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, for example, because this one has a high ellipticity. Yeah. We can also rewrite the solution by putting in this equation here. Yeah, so we can use instead omega zero squared and put that one in. So in a different form, we can write it as this. P is 32 over 5 g mu squared over c to the fifth power, a to the fourth power, omega zero to the sixth power, f of e. And there we recover the usual law we had, that the power of the gravitation wave emission goes with the frequency to the sixth power. And that's different to the power emitted for dipole radiation. If you look at an electromagnetic dipole radiation, this goes like omega to the fourth power. Because here we have gravitation waves and quadrupolar emission, we get two more powers in the frequencies, omega to the sixth. Okay. Yeah, for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, let's write this down here. For Hals-Taylor pulsar, E is about 0.617, and there it turns out that this correction F of E is actually not really small. F of E is about 11.8. So this means that the power emitted for elliptic orbits can be an order of magnitude higher than the one for circular orbits. So there's the explanation is clear. There's an additional wobbling because we have this elliptic orbits, there's additional wobbling, and that additional wobbling generates mass moments which then can be transformed to emit gravitational waves. Therefore, the emission of the Hals-Taylor pulsar is 11.8 times larger than expected from naive expectation for circular orbits. Okay. So we can recast this also in the change of the orbital period, t. And we have done this actually in terms of the frequency of the gravitational wave. Before, the orbital period t, there one can see that t is, if you look at all the equations we have above, it goes like e to the minus 3/2. So you just have to reshuffle some of these equations, and one in particular, where's a? Have I written this down? There's one equation missing, which we need afterwards also. We need another one, which is that A is given by gm reduced mass over 2 times E. So we can recast the dependence on omega and A. We can recast this in a dependence of omega and E, and that gives then the factor of minus 3/2. We can do this in the exercise. And then if we just have this power law behavior, then we use the usual methods which we learn in astronomy. We take the logarithmic derivative t dot over t and compare it with e dot over e, e dot over e. And then the prefactor is just the power we have here. So this goes just minus 3/2. Yeah. And then we can set the energy loss to be equal to one from gravitational waves minus p, and then we get the differential equation for t dot over t, the change in the orbital period, is minus 96 over 5 g to the 5/3, mu m to the 2/3, c to the 5th, and then we have t over 2 pi. This is basically then related to omega to the power minus 8/3, and then f of e. All these terms here should look familiar to you. We have seen this dependence before. Also the power, that it goes like minus 8 over 3rd, we have seen for omega. And the only difference is really this function f of e. And we will see again that here, this mu m to the 2/3, this also looks familiar to you because this is just the chirp mass to the 5/3. Yeah, so here just the chirp mass enters with the same power as the gravitational constant to the 5/3. Now that's one feature of gravitational waves, that we have this odd powers in this fancy powers in G and not really just G alone. Okay, let's put this into brackets. Okay. Yeah, in principle from this we can then also determine the lifetime of binary pulsars, how long it will take for them to merge. So, any questions so far? Okay. So now we have to talk about the spectrum. So we have seen the amplitude is just modified by f of e, but what about the frequency spectrum? So for circular orbits, we just have one frequency, it's just twice the orbital frequency. Now what is happening if you have ellipticity, and you can imagine that we have also now different frequencies which depend on the ellipticity. To study that, we have to take a Fourier transform of the mass moments. The Fourier transform, and for gravitational waves, we make a Fourier transform of the second mass moment, because this is the quantity which enters the gravitational wave emission. It goes like m double dot, the amplitude of the second mass moment. So let's look at the radiated power. So the radiated power we use the quadrupole formula from Einstein, P quadrupole is G over 5 C to the 5th power, and then in brackets MIJ double dot MIJ double dot minus 1/3 mkk double dot squared. Yeah, this is the second mass moment, quadrupole formula, minus the trace, so we just project out the trace part so that we just have the traceless component. And we're always working in transverse traceless gauge, so we have to project out the trace. Okay, so this is the general formula. Now if we have this two masses in one orbit, and say these are and we have a set direction in that perpendicular to the plane, and in plane we have the x and y direction, so we only have actually the components surviving in the 1-2 components and not in the third component. So the quadrupole formula gives for our constellations is given by 2g over 15c to the 5th power, and then we have m double dot 1 squared plus m 2 double dot squared plus 2 times m 1 double dot squared minus the trace minus 1/3 m double dot 1 plus m double dot 2 squared. Okay. Good. And finally, this then gives 2g over 15c to the fifth power of m11123 squared plus m. I'm missing dots in all my formula. Of course, this is the triple time derivative always, not the double derivative. As we are talking about emitted power, which goes like h dot squared. Okay, triple dot plus m22 triple dot squared plus 3 times m double dot 12 squared minus m11 triple dot m22 triple dot. Okay. So now one can make a Fourier transform, and the easiest way to do so is just make the Fourier transform of x squared itself. So we have some amplitudes an, say cosine omega nt, where now omega n is n times basic frequency omega zero, and y squared of t then has different components, bn cosine omega nt, and we have also a mixed one where we can assign also coefficients sine omega nt to get a proper normalization. Okay. Good. And then it follows that the power for some mode n is then given by g mu squared omega 0 to the 6th power divided by 15c to the 5th power n to the 6th a n squared plus b n squared plus 3 c n squared minus a n bn. Okay. Yeah, it goes like n to the 6th power because we have basically 6 time derivatives acting on the mass moment, so we get e the omega n, we get down with the power 6. What you see is that basically the power or the frequencies we have here get different weights because of these amplitudes here. Yeah? So basically we have all higher moments, it's equally spaced. We always get omega zero times n, so it's really equally spaced. But they have different amplitudes. And these amplitudes depend now all on epsilon. So this one is a function of basically the ellipticity, the parameters of the orbit. So this amplitude here will depend on the ellipticity of the orbit. So we just have to make a Fourier transform of how the particles move in space-time, and then this gives us automatically the frequency spectrum of gravitational waves. So I can sketch you 2 cases. Now let's do a histogram of the power emitted as a function of n. So this is Pn over P for E equals 0 as a function of n. Yeah, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4. For this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And we have an ellipticity, which is, in this case, 0.2. So this goes like this, like this, like this, and like this. And here, this is about 1. So it's normalized to the power for circular orbits. And we have seen it can well be that some amplitudes go above 1 because that function here can be an order of magnitude larger You know, so it can well be that if you sum everything up, it doesn't sum up to one, but maybe sums up to 10 or more. So if you have circular orbits, then n would be 2, right? And here we see we get also sum at n equal 1 and 3 and at 4. Now, in the gravitational wave spectrum. If we go to even higher ellipticities, you can imagine that now we have also higher modes which enter. So this is Pn over P, where epsilon is equal to 0. And again, 1 is about here. And now we have many, many more. So let's see if I can get this. We can go up to 50 now easily. 5, 10, 15. If we have an ellipticity, which is now 0.5. So imagine that for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, we had 0.6. Now the whole thing looks like this. 1, so the maximum is at 7, 8 here. 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So it looks approximately like this. And so it goes up and then down again. So there's a broad distribution, but of course we always get according to the formula we have here, we get really these equally spaced spectra. Now it depends on the resolution, of course, of the gravitational wave detector if you can really resolve this frequency mode. So of course if you have only a certain resolution, the frequency, this will smear out to one curve like this. But if you look more precise, then you would see there are wiggles, and those wiggles correspond to the modes in the gravitational wave signal. Yeah. Questions? Yeah, so the gravitational wave spectrum we expect from the Hals-Taylor pulsar. We know gravitational waves are emitted from the Hals-Taylor pulsar. We see the orbit shrinks. Energy is lost, and the energy loss is exactly the energy loss predicted by general relativity by taking into account this function here for the ellipticity. Yeah, and then we know also that the emission of frequencies shall have a spectrum which is widely different from what we have for circular orbits. And you see, this will sum up then to much more than one. We should sum up to maybe 8 or 7 for the ellipticity of 0.5. You can calculate the function actually and check how large that power would be compared to a circular orbit. Questions? Okay, then I would say let's have a short break, 5-minute break. I clean the blackboard and then we start the issue of orbit circularization and then radiation from rotating rigid bodies. Okay, let's continue with our lectures on gravitational wave emission from orbiting masses. So we were looking just at elliptic orbits, and now we're looking at effects. We have been looking at the effect that gravitational waves are emitted, and if we have a high ellipticity, all kinds of frequencies of gravitational waves are emitted. So let's have a look at how does the orbit change. So of course we know that the orbit will shrink, but now let's have a look on the ellipticity, how the ellipticity changes with time. The orbital distance, the distance between the two, will go down, the mean distance will go down with time, but what about the ellipticity? And it turns out that the ellipticity will also go down with time. So we have an orbit circularization due to the emission of gravitational waves. Orbit circularization. This is different to planets orbiting each other. There the ellipticity is basically constant, but for two orbiting neutron stars it's different. So let's make use of the following thing, that the total energy is Gm mu over 2a, We have seen this for circular orbits. Yeah, this is just the expression of the virial theorem for stationary systems. And this is minus a half gm to the 2/3, reduced mass times omega 0 to the 2/3. This is what we derived actually in the exercises yesterday. Yeah, this combination here is again just the trapped mass to the 5/3. And for L, one can use this goes like ma squared omega 0. Yeah, and then we can plug in expressions for omega 0 and a squared. And one finds that this goes like gm to the 1/3 mu omega 0 to the minus 1/3. Okay. Then we can take the time derivative of those two equations. So here we take dE over dt, the change of the energy with time is minus 1/3, gm to the 2/3, mu omega 0 to the minus 1/3, omega 0 dot. Yeah. Let's do the same with this one here. So we have the change of angular momentum. dL over dt is minus 1/3, gm to the 2/3, mu omega 0 to the minus 4/3, omega 0 dot. Okay, numerical about this one. There's a typo here. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Okay. Now, the thing is that basically the change of those two has the same amplitude. It always goes like minus 1/3 gm to the 2/3 times the reduced mass mu. So we can combine these two equations in the following formula, that dE over dt is equal to omega 0 dL over dt. Yeah. And we have using here general formulas where we have written A, so this is also valid for non-circular orbits, for elliptic orbits. So we see that the change of energy goes hand in hand with the change of the angular momentum with time. Now dL over dt, and here we have to use equation star. Just to recall that we have the following formula, E squared is equal 1 plus 2EL over G squared M squared mu cubed we had before. So from this it follows that if that actually dL over dt is somehow proportional to the change of dE over dt. It goes hand in hand with the same thing. Yeah. I forgot the factors. The important thing is that if L goes down with time, then also the ellipticity has to go down with time. Yeah. So this means, So for elliptic orbits, we find that dE over dt is negative for E positive. Yeah, and of course dE dt will be 0 for E equals 0. So one can do a quick estimate or a quick calculation for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, how far this goes. So Hals-Taylor pulsar today So today, D The orbital separation is 2 × 10⁹ meters. Now this is 2 million kilometers. Pretty close system. And the eccentricity is 0.617. Okay, thereabouts. And then if the two neutron stars are close to each other within 1,000 kilometers. Yeah, so just recall that the radius of a neutron star is 10 kilometers. So if somehow the orbital distance is getting close to the scale of the radius of the neutron star, then already one gets an ellipticity which is down at 6 × 10⁻⁶, just by using the equations we have here to get the change in E. Okay, yeah. So we can use dE over dt from the quatrupole formula. We can use this formula here for the change in the angular momentum, and then we get correspondingly a change in the ellipticity, and we can calculate that one. Okay. So you see from this very high value, which is even larger than 0.5, it goes down to really very tiny ellipticity. So this is basically circular orbits, up to 5 digits. Okay. So there's one more thing to say about non-zero ellipticity, and this is time to coalescence. We did a quick estimate for circular orbits for the time to coalescence, but it will be shorter if we have a high ellipticity. Yeah. So for the Hals-Taylor pulsar, taking this into account, it turns out that the coalescence time is boosted down by a factor 5. By a factor, and I have here 5.4. And therefore, it follows that the time to coalescence is something like 300 mega years for the Hals-Taylor pulsar. 300 million years. Okay. So far about elliptic orbits. Any questions or comments about elliptic orbits on your side? Okay. Good. Another application we're going to talk about now is radiation from rotating rigid bodies. Next section on rigid bodies. Radiation from rotating rigid bodies. And what we have in mind is, of course, mountains on neutron stars. Mountains on neutron stars. Yeah, that's so. Of course, one can imagine that neutron stars are not perfectly perfect, but there are maybe some tiny wobbles somewhere, some cracks or some mountains on the otherwise smooth surface of a neutron star, and this will introduce the time-changing quatrupole moment, and by the quatrupole formula of Einstein, there will be an emission of gravitational waves. And we're now computing the amplitude of those gravitational waves, mountains on neutron stars. So first we have to recap some basics about the inertia tensor. Basics. So we have the inertia tensor, which is defined as IIJ, is the integral over the whole body, over the mass density, and then it goes like R squared delta IJ minus XI XJ. So this is just a definition first of this inertia tensor, which is usually computed for describing some sphere, some ellipsoid, which is rotating. So rho of x is the mass density. Now we have seen this expression before. This reminds us of the second mass moment, and in fact this is just minus the second mass moment we have defined before. So insofar, this is a good starting point, and we can easily use then also the quadrupole formula. So usually one can diagonalize this inertia tensor. So it can, if you go to a proper frame, so this can be diagonalized with eigenvalues I1, I2, and I3 along the diagonal in the body frame. Yeah, so in the body frame, then this is diagonal. So let's go to the body frame. And we consider an ellipsoid which has the is described by three quantities, A, B, and C. So that I1 is then B3 x prime rho of x prime. Put in the prime there, okay. X2 prime squared plus x3 prime squared. And for I2 and I3, similar relations. Now we have here an ellipsoid with semi-axis. Axis A, B, and C. Then we can, and a uniform density. Then we can write I1 as equal M over 5, B squared plus C squared, and then I2 is equal, and so on, I3 is equal. Yeah. The 5 comes from the fact that here we have an integral over x to the 4 power, so this is x to the 5th power divided by 5. So we get an m over 5 here. Okay. So if this ellipsoid is rotating, with an angular velocity, omega, which is a vector. Then we can define an angular momentum which we denote now as ji, is given by the inertia tensor iij times omega j. Now the direction of this angular velocity and the angular momentum can be different. Must not be the same. In general, it's different. But so direction, let's see here.
direction of ji and omega of j and omega different. In general,
so only if the moment inertia is the same,
so unless I1 is equal I2 is equal I3, which basically means that we have a sphere.
Does it mean we have a sphere? Principle.
Okay.
So the rotational kinetic energy E rotational is a half times, and now it's not m vector squared. M we replaced by the inertia tensor, iij, and velocity squared is now omega squared, omega I, omega j.
Okay.
Yeah. And in the body frame, this then is particularly simple. Then the rotational energy is just a half times moment of inertia 1, omega 1 squared plus I2, omega 2 prime squared plus I3, omega 3 prime squared.
Okay, so this is just a recap of mechanics. I denote the prime here because we are working in a different frame, so also the omega can change in a different frame.
So, good.
So let's be more specific. We have a rotation around the principal axis.
So we have an x3 along this direction, we have an x1, and here we have an x2, and then the whole thing. And then we have, if you go to the body frame, we have different coordinates. We have an x2 prime, x1 prime, and the rotation goes into this direction. Omega rotation times t is the angle we have here. So in the body frame we have the coordinates x1 prime, x2 prime, x3 prime. In a fixed reference frame, we have x1, x2, and x3. And both are related by the rotation matrix. The rotation matrix is R, so that xi prime is rij xj. Okay, this you know. So, So for the geometry we have here, we're just rotating along the three axes, so we can write down the rotation matrix. We know the answer, Rij is then simply given by cosine omega times t. We have the sine of omega times t. This is minus the sine omega times t and cosine omega times t. And the rest is zero. We can do the same transformation what we have done for a vector, we can do for a tensor. Now we know how tensors transform. So Ij is a tensor. So for tensors we can write down the transformation law that Ij prime, the prime quantities are always in the body frame. So they are in principle diagonal, is Rik. RJL, RKJL, IKL. Okay. Or we can rewrite this in other notation. This is RIR transpose with index IJ. We can do the other transformation that that I is then given in the form R transpose I times R. Okay. Good. So we can write down using this one. We know that I11 is then given by I1 cosine squared, cosine omega rotation times t squared, plus I2 sine, the sine of omega rotation times t squared. Okay. Now we can use this theorems we have for the squared of a cosine or the sine. We can rewrite this as 1 plus I1 minus I2 divided by 2 cosine 2 omega times t. So similarly, one can do this for I2 too. So I22 turns out to be rather similar. This is R1 minus, and it's actually the same expression, just with a minus sign. And for I12, one finds this is actually I1 minus I2 divided by 2, and then the sine of 2 omega root times t. Good. And the other ones, so I33 is just I3, and the other ones vanishes. So we can write this down. Let's write it down where? Here. This is not a good place. So I33 is I3, because this is not. This is fixed, the axis is fixed, and the other ones 1, 3 and 2, 3, and this is a metric, so this is all zero. Okay. I just was saying that a gravitational wave amplitude depends on a second mass moment, which is just minus the inertia tensor. As we take the square afterwards, this doesn't really matter, so it's basically the same.
And we have to look now at a trace invariant part. So for gravitational waves, these are somehow proportional to mij, which is minus hij. And this will also be the same if we take the double dots. Now we need a traceless part. Need traceless part of ij. Now it turns out if we take the trace of I, this is invariant under rotation. So we need trace I. We have to subtract the trace of I. Now trace of I is invariant. As I will show now. So let's make a transformation. Trace of I is equal, I put it in a separate line. Doesn't make sense. So trace of I is equal to trace of R transpose I prime R. Okay. And now under a trace, I can rotate the order of the matrices. So this is I prime R R transpose. So this is just a trace of I prime. So this doesn't change. So we get no omega dependence on trace of I. So trace of I is basically a constant. So it follows that mij is, I should be more careful that this is somehow proportional. And in quotation marks. This, of course, is in quotation marks as we need to take the time derivative of that one. But I think you know what I mean. So this is mij plus a constant which depends on ij, where c, ij is constant. Yeah. So these two matrices are only different by the trace. But the trace is constant. So we just subtract the constant and then we get the traceless part. That's the idea. However, we don't need to know the details of that constant because the second time derivative enters. So this one I can write a second time derivative here or then the third time derivative. Doesn't really matter. For the amplitude, it's just a second derivative. Second derivatives. Gravitational waves. So this means if you look at mi m11, then this is just a minus i1 minus i2 over 2 cosine 2 omega rotation times t. This is all we need to take into account. m22 is then a plus sign and the same thing. It's actually the same thing, so I can write this is minus m22, and m12 is then a minus i1 minus i2 divided by 2, and the sine of 2 omega times t. Okay. Good. One important thing to notice is that that all these quantities are only non-vanishing if we have different moments for I1 and I2. So mij is not equal to zero only for I1 not equal I2. Here. So if we have this rotating ellipsoid along the rotation axis, yeah, when one moment I3 is pointing in the x3 direction in the rotation axis, it just means that if you have two different mass distributions in x and y directions, then we get a wobble and we get gravitational wave emission. If they have the same, then we have no wobble, basically no gravitational wave emission. That's all it says. But we can have, of course, a cigar, which we rotate around the axis of the cigar, then there will be no gravitational wave emission. So there must be some different quadrupole moment. So there must be some mountain on the cigar. Then it works. So this also means that if we look at mountains or neutron stars, the mountains have to be off axis of the rotation. Yeah? They could be, if we have a highly rotating neutron star, a millisecond pulsar, which is rotating at a few hundred hertz, which is huge, and we have a mountain which is in the rotation axis, then there will be no gravitation wave emission. So there must be some mountain a little bit off axis, which gives a slightly different I1 compared to I2. Only then we have gravitation wave emission. Okay, how am I doing the time? Good. So, okay, I need more space. So we have derived the expression for the gravitational wave amplitude in terms of M11 and so on. Yeah, we take the double time derivative to get the amplitude. So we get an H plus, which is 1 over R for G omega squared. This comes from the double time derivative over C to the fourth power times I1 minus I2. Then we have some angular dependence, cosine squared I, which is the rotation. This is the angle with respect to the plane. We have seen this before. And then we have the cosine of 2 omega times t. Yeah. Okay, and a similar expression we have for H plus. This is the same, and what is different is the angular distribution goes with the cosine I, and this frequency is offset. It goes with the sine of 2 omega t. Here. Questions? No? So now we introduce an ellipticity. This is now ellipticity for this rigid body, not for an elliptic orbit. We introduce an ellipticity. Ellipticity epsilon, which is defined as I1 minus I2 divided by I3. Yeah, so this is basically the difference in the two I's in the plane compared to the with the axis moment I3. So
for an ellipsoid with a constant mass density, this is approximately B minus A over A. For B is about A. So this is an approximate formula. It's up to linear order and epsilon, they are higher order terms. One can prove that by putting just in the definition of here, the moments here, the second mass moments here. So we see from that formula that we have this ellipsoid. As expected, in this simple setup, the gravitational wave frequency is again 2 times the rotational frequency, now of the rotational frequency of the neutron star. So the frequency of the gravitational wave F gravitation wave is 2 times the frequency of the pulsar. So the highest frequency we know of for pulsars is around 700 Hertz. So then this pulsar would emit gravitational waves at around 1400 Hertz. This is still measurable. So LIGO can measure from 10 Hertz to maybe say 2 kilohertz at most, if the pulsar is close by. So those frequencies are in a measurable range for LIGO. There are also slower ones. I mean, they are slowly rotating neutron stars who have just a few hertz, and they would be not measurable with LIGO. A few hertz is below the limit of 10 hertz. But there are many more which have a few 10 hertz or a few 100 hertz which LIGO can measure. Okay, so we can write down those formulas in a simpler way. So this has the simple amplitude H0, has this angular pattern cosine squared iota divided by 2, the cosine of 2 pi f gravitational wave times t, and an H cross, which is an H0, and this is a cosine I times the sine of 2 pi times the gravitational wave frequency times t. So that's our final result for the emission of gravitational waves from rigid bodies with a mountain or a slight offset in the mass distribution. Okay, questions about the final formula? Yeah, I should define H0. So the amplitude is given by 4 pi squared g over c to the 4th power i3 F gravitational wave squared over R, the amplitude goes out 1 over R, times the ellipticity. Yeah. We can calculate the typical mass moment we have for neutron stars. Typically, we have typically neutron stars have the following values for I. So take a canonical mass of 1.4 solar masses and say a radius of 10 kilometers. Or an offset of 10 kilometers of this wobbling mass, then I3 is 2 over 5 m a squared for constant density, 1 times 10 to 38 kilograms meter squared. Yeah. So the value of epsilon is not really known for neutron stars. It depends on the intrinsic properties of the neutron star, how much strain that neutron star can endure. So how much strain I can really put on the neutron star. So if there are forces acting, so then there must be a counterforce to sustain that mountain there. And that, of course, is possible as a neutron star has a crust, which is solid, which is a solid lattice, as a lattice of nuclei, which is the one of the outermost layers of a neutron star. So it's really like in solid state physics. So it really has some strain you can put on, like a material we have on Earth, which have a lattice structure. So it's not a liquid. The crust is not a liquid. It's really a solid. So value of epsilon. Depends on maximum strain. Supported. So neutron stars. That's what we always have in mind. But of course, our formula is more general. So there could be a boson star or another fermion star. Or if there's a dark matter star, a compact star built out of dark matter, and it can support some strain, it would also emit gravitational waves. So it can happen, for example, that would be really funny, if we have a dark matter star, which has a solid crust. Why not? We can't rule it out. And if it has a solid crust and it wobbles, you won't see it, but it would emit gravitational waves. So suddenly LIGO would see a gravitational wave signal from something rotating at, I don't know what, a few hundred hertz, but there's nothing there. There's no neutron star, no pulsar, nothing. That would be maybe a dark star. Okay. You only see the gravitational effects, but you don't see effects in photons. The neutron stars. So, the neutron stars have a solid crust. That solid crust is a few hundred meters thick. So it's not just a few centimeters, it's a few hundred meters. Have a solid crust. And one can make estimates about the ellipticity that solid crust can sustain, and that's typically solid crust and a liquid core. So that we know at some stage we have a solid crust, which is a few hundred meters, and then we have a liquid core. And then we have something else we don't know. If you really go to more massive neutron stars, there might be something else. But for our purposes, it's sufficient that we have the solid crust. And typically, if one can compute that crust, one knows approximately the decomposition of the crust, so we can use just standard methods which we have from solid state physics. And then the epsilon is about 10 to minus 6, what can be sustained typically. But this is microphysics, so there could be other effects which will change that epsilon value, and there might be higher values possible or smaller values. So then this amplitude H0 is about 10 to minus 25. Epsilon divided by 10 to minus 6. I'm using this formula up there. Then the moment of inertia I3, taking the typical value of 10 to 38 kilogram per cubic per meter squared. Kilogram meter squared, yes. Then we assume we have a typical distance within our galaxy. This is 10 kiloparsecs away. Our sun is 8 kiloparsec away from the center of the galaxy, so this is a typical distance within our galaxy, 10 kiloparsec.
And then we assume we have a frequency of the gravitational wave at the order of 1 kHz. So basically we're looking at a neutron star which is orbiting with, which has a frequency, a pulsar frequency of 500 Hz. And this goes with a square. Okay. The amplitude is 10 to minus 25. So you see this is already a pretty small value, but it is in the range of being measurable with LIGO. So, if you allow me 5 more minutes, then I will finish this one here.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Where did this information come from? Which are not
This is an assumption, of course. Yeah. It can happen if some matter is falling onto a neutron star, and if matter is falling, maybe not on the if matter is falling on the equator, then of course it is sufficient to have a different I1 and an I2, something like that. And if it's not pressed by the gravitational forces so that it vanishes, then it can maybe remain a small mountain which is supported by disorders in the lattice structures. There could be disorders in the lattice structures, as there are maybe different nuclei sitting there and forming a lattice, so it's not a perfect lattice. It has some irregularities and things like that. However, we will shortly see that LIGO sets strong, very strong limits on these irregularities already now at this stage. So LIGO measures, it can look for the amplitude, it can also look for the power radiated in gravitational waves. Okay, now this is the triple dot, so P is 2G over 5C squared, M11 squared, M11 squared triple dot plus M22 squared triple dot, and averaging over one period of rotation, and this gives 32 over 5C to the fifth power epsilon squared, moment of inertia squared, omega rotation to the sixth power. Again, of course, we see that it goes with a frequency to the sixth power, as it has to be. So rotational energy decreases. Now we have to equate that loss in gravitational waves with the loss in rotational energy, not orbital energy, but rotational energy. So rotational energy loss. So this is dE rotation over dt is equal minus 32 over, like this one. Let's put it like this. E rotating rotation is a half I omega squared. Right. And this is an I3 rotating along the X3 axis. Okay. And so we put this one equal, d rot dt is equal minus p. And if you do that, we get the differential equation. This gives a 2 omega omega dot. We cancel one omega, so omega dot is proportional to omega to the fifth power. Yeah. So it follows omega dot rotation is minus 32 g over 5 c squared, epsilon squared. Then only one power of I3 remains, and only the fifth
power of rotation gradients.
Okay. This would be for pure gravitational wave emission. Yeah, so for pure gravitational wave emission, omega dot will change like omega to the fifth power. Now, if we have a dipole radiation, we know that the energy of a dipole is proportional to omega to the fourth power. Okay. For a rotating dipole. So this means then omega dot is proportional to minus omega rotation to the third power. One can measure that index, actually. This is called a breaking index. So define the breaking index. There are several ways to do it. The simplest way is to just say omega dot rotation is proportional to minus omega rotation to the power n. You can define it also with a double derivative and making the appropriate factors to define n as a measurable quantity. If you want to really measure that quantity, the breaking index, you need to have the double time derivative to be really sure. And that's problematic. One needs really to observe the pulsar for a long time. And so a dipole would be n equals 3, and gravitational waves would be n equals 5. And the observation is that it's between 2 and 3, the standard breaking indices they see. Of course, this is a simplified model, this dipole model, and there are more complicated emission processes working on neutron stars, therefore it's different from 3. But definitely it's not as high as 5. So LIGO, that's my last point. So LIGO 2017 has published data on the limits on gravitational wave emission from pulsars, and it has actually surveyed 200 pulsars thereabout. So 200 pulsars within our galaxy have been monitored for gravitational wave emission, and no gravitational wave has been seen. So they put limits. So they put limits on the ellipticity of the Crab pulsar, which are the strongest one in terms of the spin down limit. So the ellipticity of the Crab pulsar must be smaller than 3.6 times 10 to minus 5. And the energy emitted in gravitational waves, so E dot in gravitational waves, compared to E dot in the dipole emission, must be smaller than about 2 times 10 to minus 3. So less than 2 per mil of the energy is emitted in gravitational waves. So basically 99.8% is emitted in standard radiation, in photons. Yeah. And there are other pulsars which are more rapidly rotating as the Crab. And one finds actually the epsilon min. So there are several pulsars in those entries where one sets limit at the order of 10 to minus 8. So the ellipticity is 10 to minus 8. So in terms of a mountain, this basically corresponds to something on the centimeter scale. So a mountain cannot be larger than a centimeter or 10 centimeters, something like that, on a neutron star, which has a radius of 10 kilometers. Yeah, that we know. So these are really, really perfect spheres, those neutron stars, perfectly, up to that level, 10 to minus 8. Good. So this concludes the gravitational wave emission from rotating rigid bodies. Any more questions about this gravitational wave emission? Okay, then I stop here, and I'm sorry for taking more time, but we had to start a little bit later. See you then next week.